Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. And Craig, if there were ever a year to get religion, this is it. And we're getting it today.
Yeah, well, you know, Hurricane Sally just dumped 3 feet of water on my hometown, Pensacola. So, yeah. Yeah, it's a good time to take up praying if you haven't already.
Well, this episode is going to be devoted to the interesting and unusual history of religion in Florida. And we'll be joined later by Lynn Milner, the author of The Allure of Immortality, An American Cult, A Florida Swamp, and A Renegade Prophet. But let's start
with... It's a heck of a story. It really is. I can't wait.
It is befitting of Florida. How about that? It's weird enough that it gets the Florida stamp of approval, and someone else that gets the Florida stamp of approval, Jack Murph the Surf Murphy, who died recently at the age of 83. Tell us about Murph.
I'm not sure I'd say he got a seal of approval. I mean, he did kill two people.
Yeah.
But he was a surfer in Miami. He was apparently a violin prodigy and went to college on a tennis scholarship. But what he's best remembered for is pulling off sort of the heist of the century.
Mm-hmm.
He and some Confederates stole the Star of India, which was this massive jewel. I mean, you know, like choke a cow kind of size.
I looked it up. It's a sapphire that's larger than a golf ball. And they stole it from New York's American Museum of Natural History, which I'm sure many of our listeners will have been to. And this was in 1965.
And then they brought it back to Miami and hid it under a boat. They like attached it to the bottom of a boat along with some other jewelry they'd stolen. Some accounts suggest that this was not exactly, you know, this wasn't Ocean's 11. This was because apparently museum security was notoriously bad.
Well, they were caught
still,
2 days later.
He pulled it off. And then got played in the movies by Robert Conrad, of all things. The movie called Steal a Little, Live a Lot, or something like that.
Well, there was actually a 1975 movie called Murph the Surf as well. So this was this was big news, as you could imagine, at the time.
And then, so they were caught. He went to prison. He was convicted of murdering two women, also being part of this gang that had murdered these two secretaries who stole valuable securities from their office, and then they took the securities. But in prison, he became a changed man. And when he came out, he started a prison ministry and would go around, you know, preaching to prison inmates and talking about prison reform. So there you go. That's the Florida man arc right there, I think.
Yeah. And he evolved into something of a folk hero. Again, despite a double murder rap, he only spent 17 years in prison. And, as I tend to now in 2020 look at everything through something of a racial prism, it's impossible for me to believe that in Florida in the 60s, 70s, 80s, a black double murderer who killed two women
he'd still be in there.
There's no question about it, and he wouldn't be a folk hero, and he wouldn't be talked about in somewhat glowing terms as kind of a rascal. You know, he was a murderer.
Well, it's funny, the New York Times obit, they didn't mention the murders until like way down in the story. And I'm thinking, I think I would have put that in the top couple paragraphs somewhere.
And,
I mean, you know.
And I think when we talk about systemic institutional racism, that's sort of what one aspect of it is. This guy was a surfer, and he was a great tennis player, and boy, he was reformed. Yeah, he killed two women, but he was so many this, and he was so many that. That's an awful whopper to kind of gloss over. But
he was. Well, you know, it goes into the whole. They say in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, print the legend.
He was 83, living in Crystal River, Citrus County, which is just north of Tampa. A fascinating life. He moved to Miami when he was 18, so he's not a Florida native, but was certainly associated with Florida. Obit was in the New York Times, Washington Post, everywhere. I mean, this guy was I had not heard his story before, but following Craig on Twitter at Craig Times, you got onto this right away, and certainly someone that you were familiar with from his checkered past, we should say.
Oh, yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
As we begin to talk about religion and some of the religious characters and interesting occurrences in Florida's history, many of these detailed in Craig's book, Oh Florida, which, of course, you can find on Amazon. Let's start with a character on the other side of the law, Billy Graham.
Well, yeah. I mean, Florida's, you don't think necessarily of Florida in religion, but we are sort of the sunshine state, and there's a whole lot of sinning that goes on here. So, of course, we have our own version of salvation. People don't know, but the greatest evangelist of the 20th century, Billy Graham, actually got his call to preach on an abandoned golf course in Temple Terrace. He attending a Bible college that had been started in a hotel that was left over from a country club that was open in the 1920s during the land boom, and then went bust when the land boom went bust.
Yeah.
And he would go out and sort of paddle out to an island and practice preaching at the alligators and the cypress knees out there. But he didn't feel compelled to preach to people. I mean, he was, you know, kind of going through the motions. And then one night he's wandering around on the golf course, and I think it was the 18th green. Suddenly he fell to his knees and he felt that conviction saying, you should go forth, you should preach the gospel. And so he did. And his first sermon was in, I think, Bunnell. There's a little town called Bunnell, where he had four sermons prepared, and he got up and gave the first one, and people just sat and looked at him. And so he gave the second one, and they just kept continuing looking at him. They gave the third one and then the fourth one, and then he sat down and looked at his watch. He'd been up there for 8 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, so the deacons are like, you need to work on that.
Yeah. Anyone who's done any amount of public speaking, as you have and I have, that's difficult getting used to. Yeah, time on stage is like dog ears. You'd be up there for 2.5 minutes, and you're like, oh, that's got to be like 15 minutes, right? No, not exactly. But obviously, Billy Graham, one of the most significant evangelical figures of the 20th or any century. Back in episode 2, when we talked about American Beach, you laid a great trivia nugget on us about Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and St. Augustine.
Yes, yeah, he led protests in St. Augustine that ultimately led to the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it was one of three cities in America where he was arrested. He was arrested in St. Augustine for trying to enter a white-owned motel restaurant to order a meal. And the owner kept saying, you can't come in, this is whites only. And finally called the cops on him, and the cops arrested him on the steps of the restaurant. Well, fast forward about 20, 25 years, and the Hilton people came in to buy out the place and announced, we're going to tear all this down. And the historical preservation people went nuts. They're like, well, no, you can't tear that down. That's where Martin Luther King was arrested. So they went to negotiation, and finally they came up with a very Florida solution, which is they tore down the hotel and the restaurant, but they kept the steps. Martin Luther King.
There you go.
So you go visit St. Augustine, you can go stand on the steps where he stood.
They kept the steps. That's called historical preservation in a lot of parts of Florida. Yeah. Now, from Billy Graham and Martin Luther King Jr. to a more scurrilous, scandalous figure,
yes.
Jim Baker.
Jim Baker had a multi-million dollar evangelistic ministry on TV and so forth. Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, they had their People That Love TV show. They had so much money that Tammy Faye actually could afford to have an air-conditioned doghouse for her dog. And then he threw it all away to come down here to Florida and have a sexual rendezvous, I guess you'd say, at the Sheraton Sand Key Resort in Clearwater Beach. And, you know, when word got out, the whole ministry crumbled. And this was one of those cases where I think the rest of the world went crazy, and Florida was like, what's wrong with you people? Because after the news broke, the Sheraton Sand Key was bombarded with phone calls and letters from people who wanted to buy the sheets, pillowcases, shower curtains, DJs who wanted to broadcast from the room. I mean, it was nuts. It was just nuts.
Lynn Miller, she is the author of The Allure of Immortality, An American Cult, A Florida Swamp, and A Renegade Prophet. Now, this has quite the involved backstory, so I'm going to read here from Amazon, the Amazon.com review, where you can buy the book so we're all caught up when we begin our conversation. For 5 days in December 1908, the body of Cyrus Teed lay in a bathtub at a beach house just south of Fort Myers. His followers, the Caritians, waited for signs that he was coming back to life. They watched hieroglyphs emerge on his skin and observed what looked like the formation of a third arm. They saw his belly fall and rise with breath, even though his swollen tongue sealed his mouth. As his corpse turned black, they declared that the leader was transitioning into the Egyptian god Horus. Teed was a charismatic and controversial guru who at the age of 30 had been illuminated by an angel in his electro-alchemical laboratory. At the turn of the 20th century, surrounded by the marvels of the Second Industrial Revolution, he proclaimed himself a prophet and led 200 people out of Chicago and into a new age, or so he promised. The Koreshans settled in a mosquito-infested scrubland and set to building a communal utopia inside what they believed was a hollow earth, with humans living on the inside crust and the entire universe contained within. According to Teed's socialist and millennialist teachings, if his people practiced celibacy and focused their love on him, he would return after death, and they would all become immortal.
You know, as you do. This is just a fascinating story. I loved your book so much. Starting off with Cyrus Teed's dead body laid out in a bathtub on a Florida beach is just amazing. How did you first come across this particularly Florida story?
I had just moved to Estero and living about, 2 miles away from the settlement. And I was actually making a living at the time writing magazine stories. And so, I needed ideas. And so I heard about these people and I thought, well, that'd be a nice magazine story. 2,000 words, and I pitched it, and editor said yes. And then it was just so clear that I needed more than 2,000 words. And,
no kidding.
And the Oxford American ended up turning it down because they said, this is just not, there's too much, So by then I had been sucked in, and there was so much research. I just geeked out on the research, and I just said, this has to be a book. These people deserve a book.
Well, this was early 1900s. You say there was a lot of research material. I mean, this is obviously predating the internet or anything like that. What sort of research materials and history of this group were you able to find?
Oh, my gosh. There were so many research moments that were just amazing. So Cyrus Teed was kind of, after he got his illumination, he was banging around in New York, in Western New York, trying to get followers. And he was writing back to his best friend, Abby Andrews, in Binghamton, New York, where he had left his wife because she was sick and she was inconvenient for him. So he was a doctor and he was traveling around trying to get patients. And every time he would tell a patient that he was the Messiah, they would promptly find another doctor and on he went to the next town. So he was writing letters during this whole time. It was a really hard time for him. And he was writing letters back to his best friend. Well, in Tallahassee, I found, and these were from the 1870s. That seems really young to lots of researchers who research like the Middle Ages and stuff. But to me, 1870 was a long time ago. I had the original letters. And what was amazing about them was that you could see they were handwritten. They were hard to read, not only because his handwriting was pretty atrocious, and because the paper was old, but also just because he, made little sense. So I was looking through his stuff, and you could even tell how hard he pressed his pen against the page when he emphasized things.
Wow.
So it was just like, man. That's just one example of the research that I ran across.
One thing that fascinated me was, we think of our age as being one that's full of cults. And certainly, in Florida, we've got Scientology. We've got, Santeria doing animal sacrifices on the courthouse steps
right.
in Miami. But the 1800s,
right.
there were cults popping up all over the place. It was quite amazing. And some of them were pretty wacky, involving nudity and polyamory and all kinds of stuff like that.
Right. And sometimes they call themselves cults, and sometimes they call themselves, religious utopians. The Koreshans actually called themselves a cult, but it meant something very different back then.
Really?
What did it mean?
It didn't have it. Well, to us, we look at it and we're like, yep, cult. And to them, cult was, it didn't have the negative undertones that it has for us now.
How did Cyrus Teed pick the Fort Myers area to pick up stakes and move to?
The price was right.
Simple enough. Next question, huh?
Well, and there was a guy there that was, he ended up stealing the guy's property, right?
Pretty much. It depends on how you look at it. At the time,
it always does,
the guy,
right?
Yeah, the guy was in a very vulnerable spot, as you know, a lot of the reasons that people join these, what you might call high demand groups, is when they're in a really vulnerable spot. And so he met Cyrus Teed. He had lost his wife. He had lost most of his family. His son had moved away. He had worked really hard. He was he was not doing very well. And he was prone to religious fervors, according to his son. So when he met Cyrus Teed, lore has it that he fell to his knees and he said, "My master is here," right? And so he then donated his land. And he kept a parcel of it for a while. Later, he sort of caught on that this was not a good person, and he sued to get his land back. And Lewis Hendry, his attorney, ended up with half of his portion.
Well, and Teed wound up being sued a lot, didn't he? I mean, there were a lot of men who accused him of stealing their wives.
Yes. An awful lot of women left their husbands for Teed. There were various reasons for that. There were signs that, you know, they were really passionate about him and wanted his attention. But also he preached, you know, equality for females.
Yeah.
And in 1894, San Francisco and Chicago, that was not a thing, really. And so, and the women often were married to husbands who were just son of a guns, you know? And so they thought, hey, I can be with like-minded women. I can get what amounted then to vocational training. You know, they learned how to be publishers and stenographers and, you know, interesting work and run a store and all that kind of stuff. And so the husbands, and then they obviously didn't have to put up with their husbands.
Yeah.
So they could go live in this community of women and, you know, be away from their butthead husbands. And that didn't sound too bad. But
and they shared the chores and they shared the fruits of their labor.
And the child care.
Yes.
I mean, can you
yes.
imagine?
Yes.
So they were free, you know, and they loved him. They were devoted to him. And there are signs that they fought over him and they were very jealous of when other women got to spend time with him. So their husbands came after Teed and sued him. His creditors were coming after him because he was always in trouble. You know, for instance, the people who supplied gas to heat the homes, you know, he couldn't pay his gas bill. The constable was always after him. So part of coming to Florida was you didn't need food. You could farm and you could fish. You didn't have a gas bill. And you didn't have these husbands, or for a time, you know, the husbands were far, far away. But of course, you know,
yeah.
husbands are plentiful, and that more angry husbands popped up wherever he went. But so that was part of the transition to Florida.
You really make the settlement. I mean, things seemed kind of dire in Chicago when they couldn't heat the buildings and so forth. When they moved to Florida, though, what they built there really does sound kind of idyllic. You had a great anecdote in there about the fish virtually leaping into the boat with them.
They did what's called fire fishing, and I didn't believe it. I thought it was, you know, there are a lot of tall tales. I don't know if you know this, but Florida, you know, is really full of tall tales. Have you ever
no.
you should look into that, correct? Yeah.
You're kidding me.
So I thought, the fire fishing, no, you can't light a fire on the prow of your boat and just have fish. You can. It turns out that you can. Like the fire would startle the fish and they would leap onto the boat. And the lore was that they leapt with such ferocity that some people would get knots
on their
bodies.
Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, that's back when there were so many, when fish were so plentiful, because I mean, they were in an unsettled area. There wasn't anybody else there fishing.
Well,
I don't
although,
think you could do that today.
No, I wouldn't try that today. But sport fishing was starting to bring a lot of these very wealthy men from the Northeast down. So people were catching on, and not just homesteaders, et cetera, but a lot of very wealthy men were attracted to Southwest Florida because of the sport fishing. And, yeah.
I contend that instead of naming Lee County after Robert E. Lee, who never set foot there, they should have called it Tarpon County. because the tarpon did far more for that area than Robert E. Lee ever did.
Yeah.
Speaking of tall tales, my favorite character in the book was Madame Dis de Bar. Can you talk about her a little bit?
Yeah. She fancied herself some sort of princess, and I think she went under lots of different names, and one of them was Lolita Editha. She popped in and out of his life. She had a drinking problem. She visited him. She was just a con woman. She was just a delicious con woman. And
she was going to be a follower, right?
That's what she said. But I think she was just taking notes, you know, because she wanted to run her own commune. And so they kicked her out because they discovered that she was dishonest and she had robbed these people in Chicago. They didn't want to be associated with her. And there's a big dramatic scene where she falls down the stairs drunk and they kick her out. And this is all documented. Again, the research is just incredible from journals and stuff. There was this kid playing in the yard and she looks over and she's like, oh, there's Madame Dis de Bar. And she just fell down the stairs and she appears to be drunk. Next time they see her, so she kind of goes away. She's out of the story. And then they move to Florida. And she starts popping up in Fort Myers, and it was just weird. And it turns out she followed Cyrus T. down to Fort Myers, bought some property near Edison's estate, and started her own cult called the Fruitarians. And then started coming after Teed. I mean, just coming after him in the papers, calling him a liar.
Accusing him of being the ripoff artist. Yeah.
Exactly. So they were both trying to she was trying to outdo him. She just held a grudge against him. I think she was, you know, she wanted to be the more popular messiah. They were locked in a battle of wills.
How long did Teed's commune community last before he died?
Well, he died in 1908. It was at about the peak, just a few years before he died, you know, the membership had peaked. It was at 200, 250 people. Yeah, it was crazy. It was great. And he was actually in and out of Washington, D.C., trying to found another location. And they were appearing at all sorts of expositions. In fact, they went to the Jacksonville Exposition at one point. They had a booth. It was sort of like a trade show for the Koreshian industries where you could learn about it and give them your money and land and come down and join. Or you could just buy a share or buy into the business, sort of. So he was still trying to found a new community in D.C. and then coming back to Estero to recover. And he was having lots of health problems. But after he died, that sort of, you know, began this slow decline because the people he was the one. He hadn't really appointed anyone as a predecessor. I mean,
it was a cult of personality. Yeah.
So after he died, you know, the Koreshians aged. They didn't recruit anyone new. They started dying, even though he had promised them they wouldn't. And sort of their faith sort of started to wilt, some of them, but a lot of them hung on, you know, until the 30s and 40s. And there was one woman, the last original survivor, who joined when she was 14 or 15. She died in the 70s.
Amazing. Hmm. But before we move on to the sort of the afterlife of the Koreshian cult, tell about how they tried to prove in Florida that we live inside a hollow earth.
Yes. This was so hard for me to conceptualize. So I will not go into the
don't go into the mechanics of it, but just...
No, but they had a huge civil engineering project, what amounted to a civil engineering project on Naples Beach, where they believed that the earth was hollow. And so their theory was that if they ran a straight line in horizontal space, that if the earth was curved upward, that their straight line would meet back up with the earth at some point. So they set about, they invented this thing called a rectilineator. And when I tell people about this, they say what were they doing with their... But what that means is it was a straight line. So
a variety of off-color jokes occur to me here. But anyway.
Right. Okay. So they took their rectilineator and they ran it down Naples Beach and they proved to their satisfaction that, in fact, the world does curve upward and that we live inside. And the guy in charge of it was called the Geodetic Project, I think. His name was Ulysses Grant Morrow. And this was about the time the Nobel Prize was sort of being, Alfred Nobel had just died, and there was talk among his family that they were going to start this new award. And so Ulysses, even though it hadn't really officially started yet, he decided to apply early so that when the award was announced that he could be, you know, he could receive it, the Nobel Award, because he thought that's how big they thought this was. T knew that unless he could back his claims with science, that people wouldn't listen. So he fabricated the science. It's not clear whether he knew that he was fabricating it, but he did the experimentation and the science to support his beliefs. So he used facts to support his beliefs, which is kind of like what we do today, which is one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book, is that there's so many parallels. You know, we like to look at these progressions and say, ah, how weird and zany, right? No. We are them.
Yeah, we're all guilty of confirmation bias. You know, we listen to the proof of what confirms our beliefs. So, all right, now let's talk about, okay, so Cyrus Teed has died. He did
just
not real come
quick,
back
what
from
was,
the dead.
Real quick, yeah. Craig, what was the official cause of death? Do we know that?
Yeah, well, we can guess. I actually spoke to a medical examiner and to a neurologist.
Mm-hmm.
I had some of his symptoms. I knew, for instance, he had suffered heat stroke during the Civil War, which turned out to be a red herring. I knew that he had been beaten up in a fight in Fort Myers. And of course, his whole shtick was that he was a victim. He was being tested, all of this kind of stuff. So his followers said that he died as a result of blows to his head. When I spoke to the medical examiner and to the neuroscientist and talked about his symptoms, he was writing letters back from Washington, D.C. about being hot on one side and cold on the other and having sudden pains in his arms. And the neurologist said, no, there's no evidence of blows to the head. I had pictures of his dead body that I sent to the medical examiner to have her explain what was happening, and letters that they had written while they observed his dead body. So she looked at all of those and she said, there's really no evidence of blows to the head. There's certainly no evidence of hieroglyphics and resurrection, which is what they were claiming. And in fact, the medical examiners came and from Fort Myers came and proclaimed him quite dead. So the neurologist gave me the best explanation. She said it sounded like he had severe nerve damage and nerve death. And she said, that can't kill you. It can make you want to be dead, but it can't kill you. And so we determined that it could have been, he was calling for drugs at the very end of his life. It could have been an overdose of laudanum, which was pretty, it could have been natural causes. It could have been diabetes. One thing that the medical examiner said, based on a lot of the letters that the Koreshans wrote while they were sitting with his decomposing body, they said it actually smelled sweet. Now, that could be their religion and belief, but the medical examiner said that sometimes decaying bodies of diabetics do have a sweet smell. So we don't know. What we do know is that he was not killed in that fight. The injuries in the fight were very, very unlikely to have caused his death, but the followers hung on to that because they needed that narrative that he had been persecuted.
Mm-hmm. Now talk about what happened to the land and to all of the records from their settlement. To me, it's one of the most fascinating parts of the book.
Yeah. Well, the records were all patchwork. You know, Teed, in some cases, got land by having some of his followers squat on the land, but they amassed between 5,500 acres and 7,000 acres. They owned, at one point, they owned all of Fort Myers Beach. They owned a big chunks of Little Hickory and Big Hickory Islands. They owned good chunks of Estero, of course. A lot of land. And then over time, it just dwindled. Records were bad. Opportunists came along. And then finally, there was a woman who came from, she was escaping Nazi Germany. She was a school teacher. She actually ran a school. And she came here. She found out about the Koreshans through a guy who believed in the Hollow Earth. And she came and she helped revive the place for a while. You know, she saw that it was in disrepair, that these Koreshans were aging. And she came and she kind of resurrected it for a while. And she built a foundation and then donated a lot of the remaining land to the state because she wanted Koreshanity somehow to survive. And then through that foundation fell into other hands after she died. And, you know, real estate development in Florida, you might not know this, is big, you know. So a lot of profits to be made off of this land. And so the foundation supported itself through land sales for a while. And it became kind of murky. The foundation, the purpose was sort of lost. I feel like it's pretty clear that the purpose of the foundation got lost somewhere along the way. It has since, I should say, since the book was published, the current incarnation of the foundation has really done the right thing. They've donated a lot of records to the university, the local university. They've really become involved with the Estero Historical Society. They've donated money. But for a while, they had really lost their way. And it was clear to me that greed, money, and development had really contributed to that. But one of the things that's really interesting is there are a couple of graveyards where the original Koreshans are buried. One of them is in the center of a very posh gated community called Pelican Sound, the Golf and River Club. And that was owned by the foundation for a long time. It was one of the last patches of land that the foundation sold, which was curious to me as I was putting together the book, because if you're in charge of preserving the culture of the Koreshans and you sell their graveyard to a developer, that seems not the right thing to do.
Yeah, you're not doing your duty there. If I wanted to learn more about where they lived, where would I go?
A couple of different places. One is the archive at Florida Gulf Coast University, which I should say I work there. I'm a professor there of journalism. And then the other place is the settlement. I mean, to go and walk around and see the buildings that they built.
Oh my gosh, the stuff is still there?
Yes. So
it's a state park, right? It's a state park.
It's a state park. You can even see the rectilineator. There's a section.
Cancel my plans for the weekend. Okay, so where exactly is this, and what will people see there?
So it is it's off of exit 123 on 75. So it's easy to remember. It's just west of the interstate. It's at Corkscrew and 41, US 41. And if you go, it's beautiful. It's so wooded. There's tons of bamboo, some of which came from Edison's estate. There are many of the restored buildings, including the house where Cyrus Teed lived and where, well, it's too much to go into, but there was a dental office that there were tusks on either side of the door. I think the tusks are gone. His main woman, who he had decided was his angel, ended up running off with the dentist at the end after he died. So,
we pay a dollar for every time that happens.
The tusks have stuck in my mind because of that. I just thought it was funny. So you can see the founder's house. That's where he lived. You can see they built this amazing art hall where they still have performances. There is the court, the planetary court, where some of the leading women of the society lived. He really held women as important and as equals with men. There are a couple of, you can see the old engine house. I should know how many buildings have been restored, probably 8 to 11 buildings.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, it's really neat. And then you can see the river. You can see how, especially if you go, you know, not in August, if you go in January, which is when they first arrived, you can be on the Estero River and come up with that landing and be like, oh yeah, I see why they moved here. It's gorgeous.
It is called the Koreshan State Park. So if anyone's wanting to find that out online, obviously that's where you can go and Google.
I know people are going to wonder, is there any connection between the Koreshans of Florida and David Koreshan from Waco?
Theologically, yes. And there is a fascinating, like tantalizing detail that David Koresh might have known about Cyrus Teed. The connection is this. Cyrus Teed believed he was the prophet. He was a reincarnation of Cyrus the king from the Bible. He was working on figuring out the seventh seal in Revelations. And David Koresh, you know, his name was, I think, Vernon Wayne Howell, and he changed his name to Koresh for the same reason. So he also, when he was holed up in the Waco compound, he was researching the Seventh Seal, and he had said to the FBI negotiators, "I'll come out as soon as I figure this out." And the FBI negotiators said, "Hey, we've discovered this other guy who was doing the same work that you're doing. Are you interested in reading his books?" Yes, yes. "Are you interested in reading his books?" And apparently David Koresh, as the, you know, authorities were closing in, I think that he was reading, he could have been reading, or he had at least asked for Cyrus Teed's book.
Wow.
How crazy is that? And I didn't discover that.
If only he built his own rectal lineator.
Exactly. And maybe he, you know, who knows? So anyway, so theologically they were related. They both believed themselves to be connected to Cyrus from the Bible. And that is why, so their name Koresh comes from Cyrus. It's the Hebrew transliteration of the name Cyrus.
Lynn Milner, the author of Allure of Immortality, An American Cult, A Florida Swamp, and A Renegade Prophet. This has really been interesting. Thank you so much for your time.
It's a great book. This has been awesome.
Were you raised as a church-going family, Craig?
Absolutely. We were there every time the doors were open.
What was
Sunday
the schedule?
Morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. We were there. We were singing from the hymnal and praising the Lord and putting money in the offering plate.
One of the religious Florida, I guess, interactions I think of most is the Hare Krishnas on the University of Florida campus. I was not raised in the church, don't prescribe to any sort of set of religious beliefs, but I always enjoy seeing the Hare Krishnas at UF when I go for a football game and they're doing the cymbals and banging the drums and that kind of thing. And it always interests me the lack of biblical understanding I have, because I never made any sort of connection like you did between David Koresh and the Koreshians. I thought it was simply a coincidence, but Lynn obviously was able to explain to us that no, that was not at all happenstance. Very interesting.
Yeah. The other thing I think of often when I think about religion in Florida is what happened in the town of Inglis in 2001. I don't know if you know about this.
Not at all. Do tell.
The mayor of Inglis issued a decree that Satan was banned from inside Inglis. That she wrote out this resolution and said, "Satan, you are hereby not allowed in our city." And she put copies of the resolution up at the four corners of the city boundaries. It did not keep out any of the reporters who came there right about it.
But as far as we know, Satan hasn't been seen there since, right?
Well, the guy who was running against her said, "You know, I noticed that we still have ladies of the evening waiting at the truck stop, and people are still getting drunk at the liquor store." So I'm not sure it worked, but Florida. She got reelected, though.
Well,
she got reelected.
Good enough, Satan or not. Welcome to Florida.